This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. This week, I'm looking at the so-called Islamic State and asking if they're close to defeat, and if they are, what happens next? In the summer of 2014, the group known as the Islamic State made an announcement. It declared the establishment of the Caliphate, the ideal state operating under strict Sharia law, straddling large areas of land on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border.
The Caliphate is absolutely central to Islamic State's propaganda and to its appeal. It was its unique selling point. All militant jihad groups, including Al-Qaeda, ultimately aspire to a Caliphate, which means a single domain for the global Islamic community in which Islam, or their version of it, is the whole way of life and not just the religion. Losing the Caliphate will be a huge blow.
IS has lost significant ground, most recently the eastern part of Iraq's second city of Mosul. Iraqi government troops, aided by British and American special forces, this week launched an offensive on the western part of the city. But can the group be totally defeated in both Iraq and Syria? And if they are, what happens next? First, let's look at how much territory IS currently controls and how that compares to what they had in 2014.
Hi, my name's Colm Strack. I work as a senior analyst and head of the IHS Conflict Monitor. We do quite in-depth analysis of the Islamic State's performance in terms of mapping their territorial gains and losses and looking at their finances. Over the last year or so, we've seen a fragmentation of the Islamic State's caliphate. Back in January 2015, it was about 91,000 square kilometres, which is roughly the size of Portugal. That shrunk throughout 2015 by 14% to 78,000 square kilometres, which is about the size of Scotland. And then over the last year in 2016, we saw a loss of 23%, and it's now about 60,000 square kilometres, the size of Latvia. In addition to losing territory, we're starting to see it fragment into smaller portions, particularly in Iraq. So we've got pockets around Mosul, Hawija, that are surrounded by the Iraqi government, whereas most of the administrative functions have moved to Syria.
Big losses in the overall amount of land they hold then. But how much impact is that having on IS's ability to operate?
One of the main areas that the Islamic State lost in 2016 was their access or direct road access to the Turkish border. The loss of access to the Turkish border is very important for the Islamic State because they now find it much more difficult to bring foreign fighters in and out of the caliphate. So it's really impacted on their recruitment. It's also impacted on their ability to bring trade and funds across the border into the caliphate. So it's pretty much isolated what remains of the Islamic State.
And of course, all that has huge implications for the group's finances.
We know that the Islamic State's finances back in mid-2015 were about $81 million a month. A large proportion of that, $33 million, came from oil and gas, and about $40 million from taxation of the population in the territory that they control. That's now come down by about 62% in late 2016. Particularly affected were oil and gas, which is down 73%, and taxation confiscation is down 54%.
But IS's power has never just been about territory and money.
My name is Charlie Winter, and I'm a senior research fellow at the International Centre for the Study of Radicalisation.
Charlie Winter recently published a report on what he calls the Islamic State's information warfare.
For the Islamic State, propaganda is everything. It falls across almost all of the group's operations. I think the structure is very, very hierarchical. So right at the top, I don't think there are many people at all. I think it just takes one or two or a handful of very, very visionary, very regimented and strategic thinkers.
Do we know who those people are?
No. We knew who one of them was. He got killed. Now we don't know who they are. But the narrative has remained fairly tight, even though he was killed. So clearly there are more than just this one guy who are pulling strings. And then from the centre, you have the various provinces around the world. Each of those has its own media wali, so media minister, essentially. And they liaise directly with the central propaganda office. And each of the provinces has its own media office.
So can we, and this sounds ridiculous, but can we imagine somewhere like a kind of mini BBC sitting where in Raqqa or somewhere else, a big office where people come in to do their work and their coordination and their planning?
Absolutely. The way that they frame those videos is really impressive. The language that they use is perfect Fusha, perfect classical Arabic. But what's really fascinating is there aren't that many narrators. There are 57 offices overall, and there are only five or six narrators.
So there are essentially ISIS Dimblebees and Attenboroughs out there who are really good at doing the job. And doing the job is, what, a presentation of the brand?
Presentation of the brand, but also, as well as the ISIS Dimblebees, there are the people who are on the other side of it who are doing the research. It's a really comprehensive operation. It's very, very well thought out.
And is all their stuff about war and fighting and so on? Or is there a more kind of bucolic side to what they're trying to do?
Bucolic is the perfect word for it. I mean, what the Islamic State does, which is really quite impressive innovation when it comes to insurgent propaganda, insurgent strategic communication, is it doesn't just focus on warfare. What the Islamic State does is it presents a positive alternative to the status quo.
And what have they actually shown to suggest that utopia?
Just last week, Raqqa Province Media Office released a video called Building Blocks. It spoke about how the Islamic State uses its civil service, essentially, how it uses its government jobs. It started with a bakery, showed children picking up warm bread that had just been baked and was being given out allegedly for free by the state. Then it showed emergency services being operated outside of a fire station in Raqqa.
Pushing forward a little bit, looking ahead to the loss of Mosul and possibly the loss of Raqqa, how much will the loss of, let's say, just about all their physical territory impact upon their capacity to produce their propaganda?
The archives that they have are absolutely massive. And yes, they produce hundreds and hundreds of individual media products every month. Back in 2015, it was over 1,000 individual media products a month.
But they 1,000?
Yeah. Yeah, I collected everything for the Islamic month of Shawwal, and there were 1,146.
That's well over 250 a week, therefore. And you can work it out. That is dozens every day.
Yeah. They will have been taking photographs, making videos for future consumption as well. When they lose the state itself, the virtual world propaganda in general will become all the more important for it. So even if they don't have a city of over 1 million people to boast about, they can still say, wasn't it great back in the day? The caliphate doesn't need territory to exist, even though that's kind of paradoxical. It will always be there, even if it has to exist virtually online.
So in summary, the Islamic State has lost much of its land and with it revenue and followers, but it's still there. IS has a capital city, Raqqa in Syria, and an impressive propaganda archive and the capacity to disseminate it to would-be followers around the world. I want to know if that's enough for the so-called Islamic State to live on, or can it be completely defeated? I'm in the briefing room to find out, and to help me are Clint Watts, currently Robert A. Fox Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute's programme on the Middle East and formerly an FBI special agent on a joint terrorism task force. He joins me down the line from New York. Hassan Hassan,
a senior fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle East Policy and co-author of ISIS Inside the Army of Terror. He's in our Washington studio. And Dr. Elizabeth Kendall, senior research fellow in Arabic at Pembroke College, Oxford. She's in the BBC studio in Oxford. Clint Watts, first, will the so-called Islamic State, do you think, lose its caliphate?
I think there is a mistake in the dichotomous relationship in which we talk about the Islamic State. There's only two narratives that are really put forth oftentimes in the media. Either the Islamic State is this dominant caliphate that's going to take over the world, or they're on defeat and they'll just evaporate into thin air. And I think there is a middle ground there that is much more reasonable. I think what we should more reasonably expect is, one, there will be some sort of Sunni extremist group in eastern Syria and western Iraq for as long as at least I'm alive. That's unlikely to be rooted out. But I think you'll also start to see Iraqi Sunnis, for example, start to defect. These are Ba'athist and former Iraqi army members. They'll start to fracture and break away, likely after the fall of Mosul and as the international forces sort of advance on Raqqa. And there will always be some sort of conflict there because there's no long-term plan to resolve the Syrian conflict, and there's no real stability options, I don't think, for governance over the long term. So I think it's not necessarily one or the other. I think it's an enduring conflict where it'll either be improving or deteriorating, depending on the time frame you're looking at.
Elizabeth Kendall, you've said that the existence of the idea of territory is a very important part of IS's appeal. So would you generally agree that in its loss of territory, it loses the thing that is truly unique about it?
I think in losing territory, it does lose a great deal of credibility. It's hugely undermining because the idea of a caliphate has been so central to Islamic State's propaganda and to its appeal. It completely shatters the illusion of a functioning Islamic utopia where you can bring up your children in a pure and safe environment away from the pressures of globalization. Why would you uproot your family in the West to go and move to a war zone?
How are they managing to sell their loss of territory?
Well, the loss of territory can certainly be explained away using the Prophet Muhammad himself as a precedent, who encountered various setbacks. But it doesn't look good. It doesn't look like God's on your side when you're losing in battle. And one very interesting aspect of this that we saw last year was that the main Islamic State magazine, Derbik, actually refers to, in the title, to a town in northern Syria, which is supposed to be the site for the end-of-time battle. Now, as they started losing territory, this was going to be a bit awkward. So they actually switched the title of their magazine to Rumia, which means Rome, and is a far more generic clash of civilizations. It's not too specific because, of course, having lost Derbik finally in October last year, that wouldn't have looked good.
So they didn't make the mistake of naming their magazine after yet another place
no.
they were likely to lose.
They named it Rome, which basically symbolised Byzantium and the sort of clash between Muslim and Christian empires, a much more general framing of their project.
One of the great lessons of salesmanship, keep it vague. Hassan, going back, since we're discussing the territory point at the moment and how kind of central it is to their existence, what Elizabeth Kendall said reminds us that there's, in a sense, a kind of difference between what Islamic State is on the ground and the appeal of it to people outside the Islamic State.
I agree to a large degree that the territory is very important for the Islamic State. However, I think today we see a disconnect between how ISIS is doing on the ground in terms of controlling territory or having a viable caliphate and its appeal outside. I think there is a separation today between these two things. I think that's a big loss. That's a missed opportunity by the international community to hit ISIS hard and hit it right in the beginning in the way they deal with politics as well as the military challenge.
Let's think about that in the context of the withdrawal or the defeat of ISIS in the territory that they've held, Elizabeth Kendall, because this is something that really intrigues me. You've got people here in Mosul, for instance, and Raqqa the same, who've lived for over 2 years under ISIS rule, who've gone to schools insofar as they exist under ISIS rule, who've tried to make their lives work under ISIS rule. What do you think, once that area is, if we use the word, liberated from so-called Islamic State, is going to be the situation of that population psychologically and physically?
Oh, that's absolutely a key question, because I think the success and ability to hold down a so-called defeat of Islamic State will rely almost entirely on what we then put in its place, how we deal with the traumatized populations. You know, normally we're pretty good at destroying things, and we're less good at working out what is then going to go in their place.
Well, let's talk about that specifically, because the first question, I suppose, about that is who is actually going to go into these places and who is going to hold them and who is going to do the building. Clint Watts, I know that you have some quite strong opinions about this.
Right. It is the plaguing factor over the last 2.5 years of what I've affectionately called the let 'em rot strategy, which is the sort of boxing in of the Islamic State, slowly eroding them with airstrikes and marching in a series of proxy forces and army forces, Iraqi army forces, to slowly make gains against them. And in that sense, it has kept U.S. forces mostly off the battlefield. But they cannot be removed or defeated in the way we characterize it, especially here in the West, without some sort of occupying force which can clear, hold, and build and return governance in some form. There is no one that can go in, no force that can go in and take Raqqa and hold it. And so at some level, at some point, we will have to, as the international coalition starts to march on Raqqa, the capital of the Islamic State, decide who we will deal with and who we will barter with to govern that area over the longer term. And I don't think any member of the coalition, particularly the United States, has thought that through.
Okay, can I just ask you a very quick question about that? Because
yes.
One of the things that's changed in the last few months has been the election of Donald Trump. And this has increased, if you like, a kind of rhetorical suggestion that something's going to happen for once and for all. Clint, do you actually think anything different, really significantly different, is going to happen as a result of that rhetoric? Or is essentially the approach going to be a continuation of the one started by Barack Obama?
By, I think, almost anyone's assessment of it, there's only one step tougher than President Obama, which was to deploy, you know, up to 100,000 U.S. troops to clear, hold, build, try and do counterinsurgency, much like the U.S. military did in Iraq 10 years ago. And at this point, it doesn't look like the political will is there, short of a major terrorist attack against the United States. That might be the one thing that would bring that action forward.
Elizabeth Kendall, can we talk a bit about so-called Islamic State's appeal in other countries in the region? I mean, you've done a lot of traveling in Yemen. You know a lot about Libya and other places. What do you think will happen there?
Well, I think this is definitely something to watch. When you squeeze a group or a collection of groups like Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, you might well find that they start to crop up elsewhere. And I think with so many failed or failing states around the Middle East, Somalia, Yemen, Sudan, Libya, the resurgence of Islamic State outside Syria and Iraq in places where it already has smaller cells remains a real possibility. And I think Yemen would be top of my list. It has all the ingredients for a safe haven for Islamic State fighters to regroup. It's a failed state, it's a war zone, it has a famine, it has a rampant smuggling apparatus and a vast and porous coastline, so it's accessible. And most of all, the war has fueled sectarian tensions, the Sunni-Shiite tensions, that militant jihad feeds on. So really, it's an ideal battlefront. Now, although al-Qaeda is currently much stronger in Yemen, if they manage to get together and focus on their common perceived Shiite enemy, then they could well get along.
Now, forgive me for asking what seems like a very naive question, but a lot of people thought that once old bin Laden was taken out in Pakistan in 2011, that was the end of al-Qaeda. So what is al-Qaeda now?
Al-Qaeda has been playing a much longer game than Islamic State. And I think one of the things we never quite seem to appreciate is that we can take out as many leaders as we like, but someone always comes up to replace them. The thing about al-Qaeda is that it's very difficult to define. It manages to root in with tribes. It gets under the skin of a society, and its culturally attuned narratives, I would say, although they're much rawer and much cruder than is what Islamic State produces, somehow they do chime with local populations. It's very localized.
But if you don't mind, again, it's not a naive question, but again,
Who's running it? I mean, is there someone, or should we completely lose the notion that this is somehow run like so-called Islamic State is, you know, has a series of offices, as Charlie Winter pointed out, in various places? Al-Qaeda has no such sort of centrality. It's much more diffuse.
Well, of course, Ayman al-Zawahiri is the nominal, well, not just the nominal, he is the de facto leader of Al-Qaeda globally and generally considered to be hanging out somewhere in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, although I don't know that for sure. I think they're still alive and kicking.
So to ask this, ask the relatively obvious question, so-called Islamic State had an objective, which was to have an Islamic State. What is Al-Qaeda trying to do?
Al-Qaeda also wants an Islamic State. It's simply that it says that it won't announce it until populations are ready for it. People need to be re-educated in Islamic principles, and there needs to be a general consensus for it. Your question, actually, or your statement, is key, because what could happen now is that Al-Qaeda could be considered to have more credibility because it didn't rush into announcing an Islamic State that it can't hold. It's always argued that Islamic State's announcement of a caliphate was premature and criticised its brutality. We could now see it benefiting from that.
Oh, I see. So Al-Qaeda can turn around and say, look, those fools in the so-called Islamic State, they went off at half-cock, they've messed up and so on, they tried to do things too quickly, and they were far too brutal and nasty to the local population, and we're your kind of slower burn, more kind of touchy-feely jihadis.
That is exactly right, and we're seeing messages not quite as blunt as that, but similar in spirit to what you've just said, coming out now all over the telegram wires.
By the way, if you're listening, Al-Qaeda, don't say you got the idea from me. Will attacking the West in the West still be an important part of jihadi strategy? I mean, it sounds like a selfish question given the agonies that the people in the region have undergone, but nevertheless, I think listeners would want to know. Clint Watts.
Dave, I think we're at a period where it can go in two directions. If you had asked me last September or October, I would have said that jihadis will learn and they'll make a smarter decision and they will say, look, the caliphate is a winning proposition, and it mobilizes our supporters in ways that even Al-Qaeda could not mobilize them. But if anything, they learned from both Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State is that constantly provoking the West and a global enemy brings intense counterterrorism pressure. And so I think there is a strain of localists that have learned this approach and now see places like Yemen or far-flung battlefields maybe in Central Asia is a place where they can test the caliphate model without provoking the West. At the same point, with the election of President Trump and the shift in rhetoric from Western governments, globalists again have a new opportunity. And when I say globalists, I'm talking about those in Al-Qaeda, the senior leadership, those senior leaders in the Islamic State that are still trying to survive and thrive, picking out global targets to bring back recognition and provoke an attack. The U.S. has not been more ripe since 9/11 to overreach than it is right now. And a pinprick strike by Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State would bring a massive response, I think, from the United States. And that massive response would provide an opportunity for Al-Qaeda or the Islamic State to unify essentially Muslims under their banner in a sort of battle for the end times, an apocalyptic battle. I don't know the answer to it, but I think it could go either direction.
Well, for me at least, you've created a whole new conceptual language to kind of think about the post-so-called Islamic State in, which is the battle there between, or the struggle between, the globalists who will come and hit us or the localists who are going to try and make us sort of stay away. Elizabeth Kendall, we've talked about some of the big dangers. I suppose we ought to think a little bit about what could be done to try and make sure that you don't have a recrudescence of jihadism in those areas of Iraq and likewise in Yemen and other places.
Well, I think we need to have a far better understanding of how matters work locally at a very local level on the ground. Lots of analysts and scholars claim to understand what motivates a jihadist, what is it that makes a militant jihadist. But of course, this varies enormously from place to place and from time to time. And even with the best will in the world and the biggest data set, you can't nail it down to the perfect set of ingredients. We have to be going in at a local level and working out how it's driven.
Hassan, What's your, I mean, you don't have an instant solution, but a general strategic approach to try and dampen down the jihadi possible revival after the so-called Islamic State?
You know, I don't mean to be grim, but I think this war against jihadism, as it stands, is unwinnable in the sense that the United States and other countries who are most capable of fighting these groups don't have the bandwidth to engage in a generational war against these organizations, a war that focuses on the local factors that led to the rise of these organizations in the first place. Over the past 2 years and a half in Iraq and Syria, what we've seen is that ISIS has been treated as the problem, and they were fighting ISIS as if it's the only problem that Iraq and Syria have had. The problem, though, ISIS in Syria is a symptom of a bigger problem. There is a conflict, there's violence, there is savagery committed by all sides. And only an end in that bloodbath that's going on in Syria and reforming the political order in Iraq and establishing some sort of local support for that counterterrorism strategy, that war is going to continue. These organizations, whether Al-Qaeda or ISIS or Ahrar al-Sham, all these jihadists, will learn from each other, will evolve, and we will see more groups emerging if these organizations disappear.
Clint Watts, can you hold out any more hope than that?
I generally agree that there is no victory or loss in terms of the battle against terrorism and jihadism broadly. There's just degrees of winning or losing. There will never be the complete vanquishing of terrorists globally. And at the same point, you'll never see them rise up to such a level that the West collapses, which is sometimes a narrative that you hear as well. What tends to happen is it becomes a mitigation strategy. And I think that's been the more appropriate approach over the past 4 to 5 years with regards to Syria, which is how do you deal with all these different conflicts and tamp them down to a certain degree? And ultimately, it'll be a question about, as the U.S. has sort of withdrawn almost from the Middle East over the last several years, is will this get redirected to someone else? If you look back to the original Mujahideen, they were fighting a different foreign enemy, which was the Soviet Union then at the time. And, you know, why wouldn't jihad maybe shift its target, especially from the perspective of the globalists, to a different regime or a different country that it wants to battle? So I think that's equally likely. What we'll ultimately end up having is Americans don't want to deploy, at least in the U.S. case, and probably the West as well, they don't want to deploy hundreds of thousands of soldiers for extended periods to try and restore governance to places they generally don't care about, that don't really have the underlying conditions to ever function in a democratic capacity anyways. And so with that left, you'll really see, and I think this is the turn of the Trump administration, a reverting back to using proxies, using local regimes to try and hold down or tamp down the terrorism. And even when they do that, it will ultimately give rise to another attack, either today, tomorrow, or someday in the future.
Well, on that uncheerful note, we have to end it for this week. I'd like to thank my guests, consultant Colm Strack, Charlie Winter from King's College London, Elizabeth Kendall from Oxford University, former FBI agent Clint Watts, and Washington-based researcher and author Hassan Hassan. My producer for this episode was China Collins, and research was by Serena Tarling. If you'd like to listen to the programme on Radio 4, we're on Thursdays at 8 o'clock in the evening, UK time. If you're looking for other quality podcasts to listen to, subscribe to a new series called Intrigue, Murder in the Lucky Holiday Hotel. It's the story of a mysterious death that changed the course of Chinese politics, and it's based on an investigation by the BBC's China correspondent, Carrie Gracie. Just search for Murder in the Lucky Holiday Hotel, BBC. And if you'd like to let us know what you think about the series, there's an easy way to do it. Just write a review or rating on iTunes or your podcast provider. We look forward to reading your comments.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parris. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.